to the hackers and the crackers. I see in binary, I speak source code. Step on my toes, I'll post a million JPEGs of you in a fag pose. In your digital stance, getting firewalled ho. Cause I'm riding the net in my 6-4. I was a dick with my 56. Now with my cable, I'm able to get that stable. On the out, my name is Ace and I'm a Leo. On the digital highway, my name is Neo and I'm a hero. In a flash, I'll sue you on burning Dreamcast. You need some ISOs? Let me do my hard drive rifle. Our exchange you could never stifle. In a digital hug, you just caught the love bug. I bootlegged your CD. I caused the fight between Un and Jay-Z. Your CG, it's all gonna be free. Whether we take it by force or we take it nicely. You feel that rattle in your bones? When I tell you we just hacked Dow Jones? And NASDAQ leaves you flat on your back? Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Cause I am he who loves to hack and crack. Dedicated to the hackers and the crackers. Serial code, source code, ISOs, RANs.
Hello, happy Pi Day, and welcome to Binary Revolution Radio, episode number 139 for March 14th, 2006. I'm Strom Carlson.
I'm Black Ratchet, and with us this evening is... I've never actually shared this. Is it Dubeve or Beeve?
It is Dubeve.
Dubeve. So we have Dubeve with us of Telefeek Frame.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, Telefreak fame.
For those of you who don't know what Telefreak is, it's a... What is Telefreak? You can actually... It's a conf fridge and a bunch of voicemail boxes and other stuff and VoIP goodness.
Actually, yeah, it's a teleconference bridge, stuff like that. It's also just a small group of us who just enjoy screwing around with Asterisk and developing software and just having a good time. Between our small little group of people that who actually run Telefreak itself.
You mean there's people who don't enjoy developing software for Asterisk?
But how is that possible?
Well, this is true. Well, I mean, we do other things outside of that as well. But just little projects, just a little group of us, hacking away on stuff.
General messing about.
Exactly. Exactly.
We are live tonight, and we have Dr. Zygmunt on the phone lines waiting for your phone calls, so if you want to go call in, and we're looking for phone calls tonight. I mean, we do have a topic. I actually posted in the IRC chat room today that please listen to the episodes and send us email because we got nothing, and I've had two or three people say, have you found a topic for tonight's show yet? And I said, yeah, we've had a topic for a while. And people were incorrect in assuming that when I say, please email us, we got nothing, as to mean, please email us, we have no email, instead of, please email us, we do not have a show topic tonight. So
I think show topics are more...
Either way, no one emailed us.
Well, we have, one email, don't we?
We have one email.
We can always fabricate the email.
That's about it. I was actually tempted to do that, and I was tempted just to write, 4 or 5 emails to you, Strom, on why you're... constantly pick apart people's grammar, and why you never update the archives.
Well, the lack of archive updates, which they are up to date now, has been due entirely to my procrastination, and holy God, can I procrastinate. Nobody's business.
I thought I was lazy till I met you.
Yeah. Seriously, it's just
But we are live tonight.
Laziness mm-hmm. and more. So I probably should... take an oath or something to update the archives.
Oh, we already have that covered. And you're trying to steal my thunder here with my oath. So
I thought we were going to do
so
live
email
on the
tonight
show.
Is eight. Well, we are going to do a live on the show. Okay. We're just going to do it after the email.
I see.
We're going to have 888-9 binrev for your phone calling us. So call up, prank call Beeve or whatever. We're
call
looking for topics
Dorita.
Tonight.
Yeah.
No. Also, apparently, our phone number does work in Britain, according to the person he emailed me today, or emailed me at some point in the past couple of days. So, that's 08, hold on, see if I can't pull it up here. I just read this just before the show.
0800
so
Dogball.
If you remember our UK call-in number, here we go, it's 0845, open. That's not it. whatever we gave it before, 0845, 1234567. Who cares? No one's listening in Britain anyway. Yeah, I'm unprepared. Go yell at me.
You unprepared.
Shall we just delve directly into the email?
Yeah, why not? Unless you got some sort of housekeeping to take care of.
No, I think that's basically it. Yeah, the UK call-in number, for those of you who are curious, are 0845-646-0102, which allegedly still works as of today. And what the person has been very nice and sent to us has he actually will, when you call the phone number, and you will hear a recording saying that it's going through, and it will ring our call-in number. So if you don't hear that recording, there's something messed up, but hopefully you should hear a recording. Doesn't actually say what the recording is for all we know. And could be a busy signal. Oh,
could be. You're calling Dog Balls Incorporated. Please hold.
But it says, I have just updated the dialing plan, so it plays a wait message before dialing the BRR number. I wonder what a wait message is.
Probably something like, please hold while we complete your call.
Yeah.
Yes. The following phone number is not free in the UK. What's our first and only email tonight there, Strom?
Our first and only email is from Machine Screw. He writes, I just got a new PSP and got the 2.6 firmware, which includes an RSS/audio podcasting client. I have many shows on the thing, but it seems that you dropped as of February 25th because I have so many shows I listen to I can't remember all the times the shows are live. There is Newsreel, DL.TV, Hack.5, TwitTwat, Linux Link Tech Show, The Source Show, Security Now, Dig Nation, InDigital. So please put up the dang thing. Also, in response to the Dig suing Yig, that is also not true, according to him on Twit, when asked about it, he found it as a compliment.
So this actually illustrates a couple of very interesting reasons on why people should update podcasts when they have archives. A, we've answered the Twit questions for the past 3 episodes. Or not the Twit question, the Yig/Dig question. And we've had 2 or 3 people say, hey, it's Kevin Rose, he was on Twit. But no one knows that because someone didn't update the archives. And also, we have people who are very angry with people who do not update the archives. I actually was sick and tired of receiving the hate mail, so I updated the IRC topic recently and actually said people to talk to Strom. And I guess it worked.
Yeah.
So
my incredible guilt finally got the best of me.
I guess so. So, Strom, raise your right hand and put the other hand on your computer or something.
I'm going to raise my right hand and put my other hand on my telephone.
Okay, with that. And so I said, I, Strom Carlson, will update the archives.
You forgot to solemnly swear.
Well, I don't know. I don't do these things.
Let me make it up as I go along. I, Strom Carlson, do solemnly swear to update the BitNerve Radio archives the night we broadcast the show, and if not, to do it as soon as humanly possible so that you, the listeners, can listen to your wonderful podcast instead of bothering to listen to us live. Amen.
Well, because certain people can't listen to us live. They're not all like that crazy person who were in Germany who listened to us live that one time. Like 3 a.m. or something. He completely does not know that we could have read his email on air because someone didn't update the archives, but either way. Anyway, our archives are updated now.
I wish you'd just refer to me directly instead of calling me someone.
Well, I enjoy it just further degrades you, I think.
Aw. I love you too, Ratchet.
Yeah, seriously, if this was like default radio and I was Decoder, like you'd be fired by now.
How about fuck you and I'm opening a Starbucks?
I think we should start taking bets on how long it takes them to update. How long it takes them to fall behind.
I think the over-under should be 2 weeks. I mean, it won't be this week, but it'll be next week that something will go wrong.
Yeah, go for a time frame, yeah. I think he's going to do it for about a month. And then he's going to get busy, you know, real life stuff, and then kind of fall behind. Then he'll have to take the oath again.
Yeah. I don't know. What should be the punishment if you don't update the archives?
Something involving lube?
No, you'd enjoy that. But anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, this is just, like, completely going nuts right now, because as soon as we start talking about lube, I just like, no, 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 no. So that was our one email tonight, and hopefully we'll get tons of email next week, because people who have listened to the last two episodes and will have questions and comments and such. So anyway, personal hacking stories. Strom, what have you been doing since you've had copious amounts of free time not updating the archives?
Are you kidding? I had copious amounts of nothing. I've been busy like crazy. I haven't done much hacking. Like, pretty much all I've done is I've done virus scans and stuff.
Virus scans are fun.
Yes, and I've contemplated rebuilding my Windows box because it's gone straight to hell.
You mean there was a point that it wasn't going straight to hell?
Well, no, I'm saying it's been on the journey for quite a while, and now it's there. Like, it's arrived, and there's no worse it can get.
Well, what's the rule of thumb? At least for NT, for me, it was you got to reinstall the box at least once a year.
Yeah, this I think has been since, I think, maybe April? Or May or June or something?
Yeah, with 2000 it got better, but with literally when I was running NT4... You had to install it at least once a year because it got horribly slow, at least for me. Of course, I think part of the problem was it was just fragmented to hell and there was no defrag built right into NT4. So that was always annoying, but yes, it was once a year. Basically every June when I started working at my co-op, I would have the same computer because I would work there part-time during the winter, but every year I would, like, June, right before I started full-time again, I would just back up everything, reinstall it, spent, like, you know, 6 hours reinstalling it because you had to reboot after you installed every freaking driver, and that's what I did for a day. I just reinstalled my box. By the time I started full-time again, it was nice and zippy and responsive, and then it just started the downward spiral once again.
Yeah. Also, I bought like a 400 gig hard drive to put the new install on, so that should be fun.
Yes, because you know everyone needs 400 gig hard drives. Is just me or like the hard drive space just like getting way out of hand lately?
It's just getting huge. I think that there's a decent demand for it. I mean, there's this explosion in digital media, and I mean, pretty much if I had tons of hard drive space, I'd just have MP3s up the wazoo and video, and don't forget, every episode of BinRev takes up quite a bit of space anyway, because I keep all the original files.
I mean, that's the only thing that I can see taking it, then, and only that would say it's, you know, 64-bit MULAW, so, like, that's like 150 megs a pop. I mean, when you start to, like, zooming it out, or what is it, or, like, stretching it out to, you know, 44 kilobits a second, it starts getting pretty hefty, but at the same point, you know. Oh, whatever. I don't know. I can't foresee a use of a 400 gig hard drives. I have an 80, and I have 160, and 160 is mostly full because I have like two or three computers backed up onto it that I've had to do consulting work on and reinstalled.
Yeah,
and I also back up a lot of my DVDs and whatnot. So, of course, that takes up quite a bit of space as well. Just so that I don't have to use the actual DVDs and scratch them up and lose them or anything. So I always leave them on my hard drive. So I can watch them in the living room, watching TV, or at my computer, or whatever I want.
Let's not forget porn, too.
Well, that's what I meant by videos and DVDs.
Yeah, personally, I wasn't going to go there. I wasn't going to call him on it like that, but I guess if he admitted it himself.
No, but I'm always willing to go there.
Well, technically, he admitted it to it, so it's like, I was going to say, oh, so what are those videos of? But...
Yeah, I have
you don't
want to
know.
Well, technically, I have an 80 gig hard drive, and I actually assigned 20 of that for Linux, so I don't know what the space of that is. And I have like you know 50% free on it, and I actually don't know what's taking up that much space. But meanwhile, on my storage hard drive, I only have 36 gigs free out of 150. So. I don't know. Most of that's like, you know, I know like 30 or 40 of that is just this one laptop, and his like this college student completely messed it up, and his mother gave it to me, and I backed up all of the stuff, including his like, you know, gobs of MP3s. I was actually saying, ooh, look at all these MP3s, and it was like all like, you know, Jay-Z and Kanye West, and I was like, ugh. I got excited there for a second. I was like, ooh, I could go
borrow
this.
At least that's marginally preferable to like Britney Spears.
Not by much.
That's why I said marginally.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I'm about to do the hard drive shuffle and move. I think I've got a 200 gig drive that I'm going to put in the new asterisk box I'm going to build and replace the current one because that one's all full.
Actually, speaking of hard drives, I think one of my server hard drives is going, which is annoying because it's also my asterisk box. So, actually, I know for a fact that two of my server hard drives are going, but those are just I use for storage, which are in there. Sad that they're dying, but at the same point, I really can't complain, I guess.
Should we take a call?
I don't know. I guess we could take a call.
Yeah, let's time for take a call. Just a second. You guys keep talking.
All right, yeah, so I got, like, you know, 160 gigs of storage, but they're slowly dying, but my computer's recently decided to start acting very, very slow, and the only thing I can think of is either it's got to be the hard drive, because I knew it was kind of randomly powering down.
You're making that, it's powering down? Ooh,
yeah.
That's not good.
Yeah, I'd be saying
downward.
Yeah, I need to go back that stuff up. I actually need to find out which hard drive it is, because there's two in that box, and that could be messy.
Yeah, that should probably be something you do, I don't know, directly after the show. If the drive is powering down.
Well, the drive's been powering down for a couple of months now, but the stuff I have on it has been backed up, so it's just mostly, well, let me go ride this sucker into the ground, shall I?
So I've seen bad hard drives last, like, 6 months, you know, where just people refuse to replace them. And then whenever, of course, and it dies, and then they bitch about, you know, if they lost their data. You're telling them 6 months ago, hey, you're getting, you know, read errors on your drive, but yet still don't want to replace it. Hey, it's still working.
Mm-hmm.
It's still chugging along.
We have Red mm-hmm. Rabbit on the line.
Hello, Red Rabbit.
Yeah. So, I've been talking to you on IRC for a while, and you still haven't done my AdWord page, so just thought I'd call.
He's referring to me, and he has a wiki page for telephony technology and stuff like that, and he's been wanting me to update it, and I just haven't had time. Sorry.
Yeah, so pretty bored, just thought I'd tell you that.
All right.
Call Beav out on the air. Ooh.
I know, man.
This is better than WWF.
Yeah. And you know what? I'll get it done so much faster now, let me tell you.
Yeah,
now that it feels like an obligation instead of something you just want to do, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Hey, just Red Rabbit, just look on the bright side. At least Strom's not up after updating it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I did tell him that I would do it, and I just have not done it. And I do apologize. I'll get it done. Just give me a little bit of time.
All right. See you.
Thanks for calling.
All right.
Well,
so, yes, actually, getting back to hard drives, what I was going to say was actually my fiance's hard drive, which is part, I guess this is part of my personal hacking stories. My fiance hard drive, Wednesday, her computer just refused to turn on. It was just sitting at a blank cursor. I was just like, I don't know what the heck's going on here. And eventually I turned it off, turned it on, and, you know, a couple of times the power cycle didn't, it magically restored. I said, you might want to back your stuff up. We'll do it this weekend. Friday night, you know, she comes in, we're going to do it Sunday, and Sunday morning she powers it up, nothing, it just sits at the login screen and it crashes when it starts up, so had to trudge over and salvage all the stuff out, and it was a very interesting Sunday and Monday night. I was sick as a dog, yet I was still scraping stuff off the hard drive.
Have fun.
But I would just like to send a wonderful shout out to Bart PE, which is Bart's pre-installed environment, which is, for those of you who don't know, it's like, basically it's Nopix for Windows. It's a very good bootable CD, and basically what you have to do is you have to have a full copy of Windows XP, and you can create this bootable ISO image and burn it to a CD that will boot a stripped-down version of Windows on your computer. And you know, Nopix is a lot more full-featured, and a lot of the stuff in the Windows one is a kludge, but it's very handy for, say, removing spyware and directly interfacing it in. It's a lot handy with when you're already working in a Windows environment. Say, like, for example, the hard drive is NTFS, which is a slight bear to work with Linux. So, Bart PE, it's the best thing ever, and I think we should, like, do a show on, like, RPE and Nopix and bootable Windows and all that kind of stuff. The URL for it is tinyurl.com/QuebecPapaKilowattYankee. And as for my other person, I don't know, what else have I been doing this week? I've been doing some stuff relating to the show topic, and we'll talk about that later. And, yeah, that's basically it. I've been sick. And I don't like head colds.
One great thing whenever you lose a hard drive, that especially has Linux on it, is DD Rescue. I don't know if you've played with that. But that's a very useful utility. Even if the drive is physically failing, if you let it run long enough, it'll usually come back with an image that you can recover from. But you might have to let it run for a couple of days on the drive.
Ouch.
But very, very useful. But it works. It's gotten me out of very bad situations twice. So if you're looking for recovery tools, I'd highly suggest that.
No. Sounds like you've actually done this a couple of times. Have you actually put the hard drive in the freezer before?
Actually, yes, I have.
And has it worked?
It did zip for me. See, the thing that I heard about it was that the idea, at least that I had heard, is that sometimes on a circuit board, the circuit board's gone bad, and you have particular parts that are overheating. So the idea is to cool down the hard drive so you can get it to spin up long enough to get the stuff off the hard drive before the parts on the hard drive board start to reheat up, if you kind of see what I'm saying.
Yes, yes.
At least that's a theory that I've heard. I tried it twice, and it never made a bit of difference for me.
Well, I think it depends really on which kind of
What kind of failure?
Well, yeah, what kind of failure it is. One thing that has tended to work for me in the past is if the board goes, you get the exact same hard drive and you just replace the board but leave the same letters. And you've got pretty much a working drive again.
Yeah, actually I have done that where I had a friend of mine who lost an 8-gig hard drive a while back. And it had, I think it had Windows on it. And that's basically what I did is I went on eBay and found the exact same model drive. And then whenever, you know, it costs like $5, and then replaced the board on the drive and got it to spin back up just long enough to get the data off. I wouldn't say I'd use the hard drive anymore for critical data.
Yeah, of course not.
It was kind of clutched together at that point. But, yeah, you're right. It does work.
Yeah, don't give it to those people who ride their hard drives into the ground. I actually got to say, that I think I'm the only person who's ever actually said this, but the freezer thing has worked for me, I guess. I don't know. Maybe I'm just lucky. And actually, I did say that once on MinRev Radio, and no one believed me, and that made me very sad. So, Beav, what have you been? Do we ask you yet? I'm not even sure. What's your personal show and tell this week?
Well, let's see. I've been working on iWar a little bit, trying to get the next release of that done with. Still doing the Death Row thing, Death Row Open VMS Cluster. Maintaining that. Nothing really interesting there, and of course tonight's topic I've been doing a lot of work with. That's been primarily what I've been doing. I just had a lot of work with iWar and trying to get all that stuff done with. So,
are we looking forward to any new features with iWar?
Yeah, actually I've added in Postgres, whatever.
I think we established PostgreSQL. Yeah, PostgreSQL.
Okay, PostgreSQL. I added that in, HTTP logging so that you can log to a web server. And a couple other features. My big thing right now is to work on signal processing for the voice over IP part of iWar, which have not had much of a chance to really work on, but been too busy smashing bugs in the current iWar. So
Beav smash, bro.
Smashy, yep. Smashy.
Gotta be done.
I'm just picturing Beav, like, you know, trudging over the crude base with, like, you know, his, you know, all green, like his shirt ripped to shreds like the Hulk. Ashy,
don't like bugs.
Yeah, that's so pretty much the way I dress whenever I do it too.
All right, so since you know, we both basically referenced a topic in the past 5 minutes or so, the topic for the night is we're going to talk about honeypots and user mode Linux and the the immense fun you could have just sitting there, you know, mushing about with UML and honeypots.
The honeypots topic makes me sticky. And that's the end of my bad joke for the evening.
Honey.
Yes.
Okay, so, well, I mean, I guess it's like, you know, two or three people that might not know what a honeypot is. Honeypots are systems that are basically, you want to deploy them into your network infrastructure even though they have security holes in them. I mean, they're basically boxes that no one else is going to use, and they're just going to sit there, you know, badly patched or whatever. Like, for example, most people who know what they're doing, when they have a, you know, computer on the network, they actually want to patch it. Honeypots, you don't want to. You just want to have them sit out there with their giant gaping security holes. Basically, what they're used for is, you know, research, information gathering, and some companies...
And fun, too.
Yeah, so also some companies apparently use them to distract hackers, attackers. And basically, what they're trying to do is they want to just set them out there on their network, and you know, with their security holes and their badly configured and their default passwords, and so if someone comes around and attacks your network, they'll see this box with all these problems, and they just are meant to set up to look like low hanging fruit, like the easy stuff that anyone can you know own with their you know copy of Back Orifice and NetBus and all that stuff. You know, they just want to be low-hanging fruit, you know, computers with very easily exploited weaknesses. And what the concept is, you know, when you have one of these computers out there, or they'll have enough holes to make it look like a badly secured box to the attacker, you know, and when they come around, it'll convince him and her to make sure that box is, oh, God, this is going to be the simplest one ever, and I can use this for my base of operations to attack everything else, which is a very common strategy. Now, what the attacker doesn't know is the machine is heavily monitored, and basically whenever someone tries to connect to it, because you don't want anyone else, you know, if this is part of your network infrastructure, you don't want, John from accounting using that as his primary server. The only person you want to ever use this box is someone who shouldn't be using it in the first place. And if some type of traffic is flowing in or out of it, it's going to be something that... is you want to be looking at. So, I guess, personally, the first part that I ever, like, stumbled across for, like, honeypots and security stuff like that is, and it's a very good basic introduction. It's called An Evening with Burford, and it's by Bill Cheswick. And this actually is a chapter in his book, Firewalls and Internet Security. The book's by Cheswick and something else. I have a copy of it, actually. I bet if I look at my bookshelf right now, I can see it. Cheswick.
Squint.
Yeah, I think I'm going to need glasses. Cheswick, Beldewin, and Ruth? I don't know. Down on my bottom shelf. I'm getting old. I'm very sad.
Old fart.
Yeah, it's a chapter in his book, but this actually isn't, you know, books with a Z there. It's super elite. He's actually released this chapter to a public, or I'm not sure if he's released a chapter to the public or he released a story before he released the book, but it's actually available on the public. It's tinyurl.com/lima3echo8alpha. And you can also, I have a PDF copy of it on my computer at work, and it's a really great story. It's him during, you know, this is like way in the origins of the internet. It's like 1991, and it's a story on basically how an attacker, and I wrote this myself. Ooh, someone has a hip-top. It's how an attacker is basically tricked, trapped, and traced. It's really cool, and I gotta say it's a lot like a whodunit story. It's really good. Basically, it's you know this Cheswick guy, Bill. He's working for AT&T Research, and he set up a honeypot on AT&T's internet connection. And this person from Netherlands, Sweden, some sort of Scandinavian country. He basically hopped it all the way through like two or three different computers, and he attacked AT&T, and they basically put him in this little jail, and they watched everything he did, including hacking other computers, and they just, you know, watched him for, I think it went on for a couple of months. It was pretty interesting. So when like, previous to what we're also going to talk about, like, back in the day, what you have to do is you'd have to take an actual computer, like, you know, put a hard drive, put RAM, put everything in it, misconfigure it, and basically let it run 24/7 and wait to see what comes drifting in on the tide. And really, this was the only way to do it for a while. Until like, you know, computer virtualization and all kinds of fun stuff that we're going to talk about next. And while actually researching this article, I found a fun little thing. The term honeypot is often understood to refer to the British children's character Winnie the Pooh, a stuffed bear who was lured into various predicaments by his desire for pots of honey. Which, I always saw the logo, but I never actually understood that that was the origin of the term.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I never really thought about it myself.
I always saw it like, it was sort of like, you know, it was a honeypot. I mean, I always looked at it as a play on the term of, you know, you attract more flies with honey than vinegar.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought.
Yeah. Or, I just see, like, I always saw it as, like, you know, this hacker's, like, walking around the network, and he sees this, you know, pot of honey, and it's like, woo, honey! Because, you know, who wants to turn down free honey?
Exactly, yeah. That's kind of the way I thought about it, but...
Yeah, so, yeah, but basically what it is the, you know, honeypot was, you had to run it with a, you had to run into a physical server, and you had to run a computer, and you had to keep it in your, you know, server room, closet, bedroom, wherever you want to put it, underneath your bed, whatever. And then, like, up in, I think, 1996, when did UML come out? It was released around 2.2, so I'm going to say, like, 1998, 1999. One of the first big things for, you know, network virtualization, at least in the Linux world, was something called User Mode Linux. Now, what User Mode Linux does is basically it allows you to run a virtual kernel on top of your existing install. So, you know, normally when you are booting up a Linux kernel, you have to have, you know, a piece of hardware to do it, and you could only have one kernel running on a machine. What User Mode Linux did is they took all of the, you know, they took the requirements of running a Linux kernel into kernel space, and they made it all into user space. And for those of you who don't know what, you know, user space is, user space is the area in which your normal program runs, like, you know, Apache, Secure Shell, NFS, while opposed to your real kernel runs in something called kernel space. Basically, what kernel space is it allows the kernel to directly access the hardware, you know, low-level functions, you know, pull stuff out of RAM directly. While in, like, user space, the kernel kind of, I guess you could say, insulates programs when they're trying to access the hardware. Like, for example, compare it to, you know, running Linux and running DOS. DOS didn't have a kernel, and therefore lockups were a lot more frequent when something happened to the program that was currently running, as opposed to Linux, where if you have a lockup, something's seriously wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, your hard drive might be dying. Ha
ha! What's interesting is I actually set up kind of a... I had an extra box, an extra IP, so I set a honeypot up. I just set up the computer with this open FTP share sitting there on the network. No firewalls or anything, and I just let it sit there for a month, and no one touched it. I was so surprised.
Hmm. We're actually running into that problem ourselves.
I think a lot of times you just have to be really patient or just make your machine more vulnerable as you see the attacks come in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you also got to be paying attention to what, you know, the attack du jour is, I guess. I mean,
Really, yeah.
Yeah, well, what I used to do is when we'll talk about more about this later, but I set up back in the day, about, a year ago or so when I first started playing with this, I basically set up a nice little... HoneyD install, which is a HoneyD for those, we'll talk about it more later, but HoneyD is a sort of a virtual honeypot. And I set it up to have a telnet, make it look like a telnet session was running on it. And I programmed the hell out of this. You could telnet in, you could give it passwords, it would make it look like it was compromised. You know, you could enter like one of like, you know, three or four different accounts and it'll respond to it and give you a login prompt and then, you know, not respond to it and then it would lock you out. But no one would log in because no one uses telnet anymore. And that made me sad. But, yeah, and it's just basically what it boils down to is the attack du jour. What are people running right now? I mean, meanwhile, I actually set up something soliciting on port 4444, which was the, I forget what that was. It was the, what virus did that? MyDoom on Windows that would send the shell out to that? Or one of like the, there was like a spat of viruses. You know, it would bind a Windows command shell out to a certain port, and I set that up there, and I would get hammered like, you know, 100 hits a day on it.
The blaster worm.
Blaster, that's it, thank you. One of them, it was like way too many, and then I think Nimda did it too, basically because Nimda used blaster as a piggyback. It was very interesting. So, what UML basically allows you to do is, you know, you can run buggy software on an actual quote-unquote Linux server, or a Linux kernel install. You can jail certain services, so if, you know, if you're running a real computer and you're running like a real Apache website, you can set up so Apache runs on your user mode Linux box, and if Apache gets hacked, say, for example, your main box will get hacked, your super elite porn won't get spoiled out on the internet. You can also use user mode Linux to limit access to hardware for certain programs, and generally just basically provide a level of redundancy for the systems that you run. Like, for example, if something happens to, say, your Apache program and your, you know, that virtualization gets taken down, your Samba will still be fine. And it's just a way of, you know, redundancy for the sake of redundancy, I guess. Essentially, what user mode Linux does is it provides a nice little way to run a virtual instance of a server within your existing server. And actually, I found this pretty interesting. I completely forgot about this until someone mentioned it to me. There's a couple of web hosting providers out there that are actually starting to provide user mode Linux powered servers for like, you know, $10 to $20 a month. Where in reality, you get this complete virtual server, you know, full root access. And what appears to be your own system, while in reality it's only one physical computer and it's shared by many people. I forget the provider that actually does this. The one that I actually use. Yeah, apparently there's a lot. I did a search for it. I remember when it first came out, and me and a couple other people were basically saying, "Wow, this is the coolest thing ever." And one of them, that actually one of the people that Strom and I know actually still uses theirs. It's real. I played on it, and for all intents and purposes, you can tell that you have a, you know, real Linux box. It's, unless you really start poking at it, you won't discover that it's just sitting in someone's virtual space someplace.
Right.
UML first came out around for 2.2 kernels. I think it was like 98, 99. And as of Linux 2.6. It's actually got integrated into the main kernel source tree. It's pretty cool, actually. I didn't actually know it was a part of 2.6. For a lot of people with 2.4, still using that, all eight of you, it's going to be a bit of an issue because apparently, sadly enough, development hasn't actually done much since late 2004.
And actually, ironically, for UMLs, I find the 2.4 UML kernel better to run because it supports some features that the 2.6 has yet to have it integrated into it, which we can get to later.
Yes. Well, actually, I think 2.6 is mostly developed by the Linux people and not actually the UML people.
I'm not exactly sure. Still developing that.
Yeah, I don't think. Oh, really? Well, I don't know. It's just odd the way everything kind of works out. Because, I mean, I was running user mode Linux with Debian binaries, and I basically, you know, I started running it, and I said, oh, I wonder what version we're running in. It said, like, 2004, you know, July 7th. And I was like, oh, crap, man, these binaries are lagging way behind. And I was like, okay, let me go uninstall them, and I'll go grab the source. And I go to the website, and I'm like, 2004, July 7th. Wait a minute. I was very confused for a second. So, you know, we talked about honeypots, we talked about UML, and I'm sure all of you are just sitting on the edge of your seat wondering how you can put two and two together and make this super cool UML honeypot.
Does it involve cheese?
Well, I don't know. I guess when you're setting up your honeypot, you can have a nice little, you know, bottle of Chianti and nice little some wine there. Maybe a nice little white Zinfandel.
Mm.
Linux cheese and wine.
Yeah, there we go.
Actually, I found it amusing. I got into Linux World, and I was looking at some of the stuff you can go to, and apparently there is a cheese and wine party.
A Linux cheese and wine party.
Yeah, I know. I was like, whoa, okay, that's going to be pretty interesting to watch. So, anyway, what makes user mode Linux pretty good for honeypots is that it basically allows you to run a badly secured Linux box on top of your well-secured Linux box. And
oh, sweet.
Yeah, if the badly secured box get rooted, your main box is fine, and there's no really way for them to... Hell, if you actually pull it off well enough, they shouldn't even know they're in a virtual instance, and if they do realize they're in a virtual instance, there's no real way to piggyback off the user mode Linux image and attack your well-secured machine.
Well, as you're pointing out, and let's assume that there is some way to do that, you can even run... You're actually running the UML kernel within user space. You can actually run it under a standard username. So even in the event that they do get out of it, pretty unlikely, you can still can even jail it down even more by, of course, you know, not running your UML instance as root, for instance.
You know what I should do? I wonder if I should run my user mode Linux, my badly secured user mode Linux, inside a well-secured user mode Linux inside my host machine.
Ooh, I wonder if you can do that.
I don't even know, but I'm gonna find out.
Double stuff paranoia.
I've heard people running user mode Linux and then running vServe, which is another kind of emulation kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
Within user mode Linux. I couldn't quite figure out why, but
they
I was
like paid.
Watching a yeah, they exactly. Like it was like a user mode inside of a vServe mode. Okay, but I guess if you're really paranoid, you could do that.
What we should do is you should use, like, you know, your host machine, then QEMU, and then VMware, running Zen server, running user mode Linux with your badly secured box. So they're like eight different ways.
That way, when they actually log in, it'll be kind of like, hey, why am I using a 386 that claims to be a Pentium 4? I'm not, you know.
Right.
Well, actually, I was fooling around with VMware because they released their free version. We're completely getting dragged off the main topic here, but we're kind of talking about virtualization. And all of these products we're mentioning, VMware, QEMU, Zen Server, and what was the one? The Bware, whatever it was? BServe? Beev?
BServe? No.
What were you talking about?
Oh, vServe, yeah.
vServe, sorry, yeah. All of these are virtualization things. And you can basically use all of these programs to do exactly what we're talking about. Basically just, you know, hosting a badly secured machine, making a virtual network instance, and running it on top of your existing server.
Well, actually, what's interesting about that is I found user mode Linux to be better for honeypots. Because, for instance, like in vServe, it's really easy to kind of figure out you're in the vServe environment because it runs under the existing kernel. It just makes a new security, it makes a new context for your virtualization to run in. You actually don't run a different kernel. You're under the exact same kernel as the host system, if you kind of see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also looked into stuff like VMware, especially Windows honeypots, kind of easy to figure out. Anyways, all hands pointed for me to UML because they have actually put in a lot of time and effort into making UML a honeypot-friendly kind of environment because you can actually change the way the setup, you know, way the system looks, you know, so that it's harder for the person to detect that they're actually within a UML environment.
Yeah, UML is basically all of the, you know, honey nut people over there. Like, they all sing the praises of UML. But, for example, UML won't run Windows. So if you want to run VMware, you can run VMware on a Windows. You can run a VMware on your Linux machine running a Windows image. You have to have quite a powerful machine to do that, of course, as I found out.
You can also do it in QEM, too. So.
But, oh, really? I didn't know you could do that in Windows.
Yep, you sure can.
Oh.
You can run Windows in QEM. But
yeah, I was actually fooling around with my Linux box and said, I'll run a virtual Windows 2000 server on here, and we'll just see how it runs. And I sort of like gave up when VMware started up and started booting the Windows, and my load eventually topped out around 17. And I said, okay, I don't think this is going to work. The virtual network instance started responding to pings, but like you'd see, 2 milliseconds, 3 milliseconds,
wow,
30 milliseconds. 4,527 milliseconds. And I was like, yeah, I don't think that's a good ping time.
We've got a caller on the line. We've got
Maybufo
from the IRC channel. He's got a question about what we're talking about.
All right.
Yeah, hi. You guys are talking about running honeypots on Linux.
Yes.
And I'm just curious. Wouldn't one on Windows attract a little more people?
Well, that's the question. But of course, with user mode Linux, basically you're basically limited to Linux.
Well, right.
But at the same point, we were talking about VMware and everything, and you can run a honeypot with VMware for Windows. But at the same point, it's questionable.
You can't. One problem that I kind of had with it, because I originally wanted to run a Windows based honeypot, and instead went to UML. With Linux, because the UML team has put a lot of effort into, things like logging and stuff like that. So even if the person SSHs in, you can still log their sessions. And
right.
Whereas VMware, it gets a little bit more tricky about how you're going to log the sessions, and see what the actual, the person who penetrated the system, what they're actually doing, aside from, like, taking the image down and doing, like, post-mortem on the image or whatnot. That was the reason I went with it.
Okay. That's pretty interesting, though.
Yes. Well, we'll actually cover about how to like set it up and all this wonderful, cool honeypot stuff. Actually, we should talk about it now because we're right at the part of the notes where we should be talking about it.
Yeah.
So the three things with UML that made it so well is basically we're talking about TTY logging right here. And, well, do you want to talk about TTY logging? Because you just, basically did this for about a week or so.
Yeah, sure. The only bad thing is in the 2.6 kernel of the UML stuff, they don't include TTY logging. So you have to kind of resort back to a 2.4 kernel. And what it allows is anything that goes on within your UML, you can log it. So it doesn't matter if the user has actually SSH'd in, or pretty much how he gets into his system, it creates a log file that you can later go through and actually even play back in real time, just like the person was sitting there, typing it in. You can actually play back the log file and watch what they're doing in real time. Unfortunately, 2.6 kernel, they don't have that ported over. So, but that was like a definite, that's a pretty big advantage to me. I like to watch what's going on.
When he's talking about like playing it real time, you're playing it in real time. It's eerie how it looks when you actually start playing it back. You can see typos and everything.
Exactly. And what's interesting is from the intruder's standpoint, it's very difficult for him to detect that the logging is going on because there's no additional network traffic because. Really, I believe the UML Linux is just passing the information back over to the host system. So there's no real extra traffic. So, like, let's say he decides, to see if there's some sort of extra traffic, to see if, like, syslogging, remote syslogging is going on. He's not going to see it. So that also makes it more entertaining, makes the intruder feel more safe that he isn't being watched when he actually is.
Yeah. And also with one of the other things they put in is HP PFS, which is basically a way of just running this complete like dumbed up proc system. Because when you normally logged into a user mode Linux, if you look at the proc system, for those who don't know, proc basically gives you a lot of internal operating system statuses in Linux. If you look at proc, you can see, oh, you know, if you look at it, you say, oh, look at that, I'm in user mode Linux. But what you can do with some tools that they give you is you can basically make the proc look exactly like it's supposed to. And what HP PFS stands for is the Honeypot Proc FS. You can have certain proc entries added, deleted, modified. Basically, you can make it look like you're running this, you know, super 8-way x86 processor for all they know.
Right.
Really heavily loaded down.
Yeah, it's really slow. I don't know why.
It's got 8 processors. Processor host.
And they also have something called SKSS mode, which is basically a separate kernel address space. And if you're making, basically what it just does is it kind of, if you're looking at how the user space and kernel space stuff is allocated within the memory on the UML host image, you can notice that it's following certain rules, and it'll look like if someone knows what they're looking for, you can tell, oh, okay, it's user mode Linux. What SKSS does is it kind of obfuscates that and does not make it look like it's supposed to.
It's
camouflage. Yeah, it makes it look exactly like a real system. I actually haven't played with that, so I'm not a complete expert in it.
Are you still on the line, Mibufo?
I am.
All right, cool. Any more questions?
No, not really, though.
All right, cool. I've got another call I'm going to grab, so
okay.
I'm going to drop you off.
All right, no problem.
Thanks, man.
Sure. So our next caller is Potrillo 23 of Twat. Because apparently someone leaked the topic tonight for today's night's MinRev episode, and I get a message on IRC. My God, did you get inspired by my Twat episode? I'm like, what? And apparently, last week or the week before, he did a Honeypot episode on Twat. So if you want some little more information than maybe covering stuff that we're not covering, like, for example, I think he talks about VMware and such. Go to Twat. I think it's like episode 80. And listen to Petrillo talk about honeypots.
What's up, guys?
Hey there.
All right. I'm just coming over here from L.A., over here near Ustrom. I was doing some research earlier last week on honeypots myself and found some pretty interesting stuff on VMware. Turns out that VMware assigns certain MAC addresses to its virtual host, so somebody on the LAN could lead to the assumption that there's a honeypot hosted. So I don't know, I just thought that was kind of interesting, thought I'd share that with you guys.
Well, does it necessarily mean that the honeypot's there, or does it more mean that it's actually a VMware instance?
Well, yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a honeypot there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it could just like tip you off, you know what I mean?
Yeah, like for example, if mm-hmm.
Were you about to say whenever they load the video drivers for VMware? Because that's another like tip off for people hosting VMware based honeypots is, of course, whenever you boot up normally, if you don't install the VMware drivers within the VMware environment, the graphics are really bad. You know, you get like, you know, 256 colors, and it just looks like crap. But you can load all these drivers for VMware that'll actually, you know, make the machine respond and act fairly decently. The only problem is if you're running that as a honeypot, then if people see those drivers loaded, like the VMware video drivers loaded, it's pretty much a key op that, oh, this is a honeypot. Never mind, you know, or this is a VMware-based machine.
That's cool. I never heard of that before. I'm going to look into that a little bit.
You might be able to get around it by just not loading those drivers, but, of course, your display is going to look like crap and whatnot. But
well, to be honest with you, if your display looked like crap, I mean, you're not going to be using the bloody thing. Let them suffer.
Right.
That's true.
So I guess I can see it from both sides of the coin. Yes, but, both Beav and I were playing with honeypots today, this week, and that's what we were talking about when we were talking about the show topics. And I'm actually, for a while I was getting probed by Verizon, out of all people, and like this like entire /16 just random Wind servers were trying to connect to my computer, and my Snort protection log were picking them up, and I couldn't tell what the hell was going on. And what I really wanted to do is I wanted to just fire up VMware, just have something that was, you know, not my real Windows box, you know, have a Windows Server instance, you know, fire up a Wind server, have it unpatched, and let's see if I get, you know, owned by something, and whether or not they're actually just trying to send out harmless packets that look kind of suspicious because I didn't ask for them, or actually whether or not they're sending out some type of worm of some sort. So, I mean, VMware does have its place, but at the same point, it's not as easily camouflaged as user mode Linux.
Yeah, I've often wondered if QEMM or whatnot.
QEMM, you're dating yourself there.
Yeah, I know. Thanks. Yeah, I got more conventional memory out of that.
God, I remember
anyway,
QEMM.
quick pop quiz: what does QEMM stand for?
Like the
oh my God.
The quarter deck expanded memory manager.
Oh, that's right.
I wanted
to say Quark Express memory manager. I'm like, no, that's not it.
Okay, Beav, you can keep on going. We'll start back on topic.
Well, anyways, I'm wondering if you'd be better off running it in something like that than, say, VMware. I wonder if it'd be easier to camouflage. But I don't know. I was just thinking out loud, I guess.
Well, I think we're going to have to look at QEMU here, or QEMM. And
yeah.
But I actually had no clue that I could actually win Windows, which was really interesting. All right, so, you know, basically what the advantage of running a virtual network instance is, you know, you don't need a separate computer to run it. It has less power consumption, has less cost, you know, less space is taken into your rack or your server room or your bedroom, for that matter, and all your monitoring software can be on your host machine there. So all the stuff that's actually, you know, looking at this stuff and monitoring it, making sure nothing mean happens, all of your stuff is, like, you know, right on your host machine, so, you know, it'll notice it. It's a type of, like, you know, ARP spoofing or any type of crazy thing, because if your host machine mysteriously goes offline, so won't your honeypot. Sorry, Petrillo, but are you still here?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, do you have any more questions?
No, I'm all right.
Yeah, I just completely forgot to mention you there.
That's all right.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much for calling in.
All right, I'll see you guys.
See you later. And that's,
later,
oh,
man.
By the way, that's oh, guess not. I think that's Twat episode 80. I figured that he would know, but I guess not. Okay, so setting one up is really simple. I had one about 10 minutes running on Debian, and It was insanely simple. It was basically this guy has wrote this very nice tutorial. It's about, like, you know, I think it's like 5 packages you have to install. And once you do that, it's just a matter of downloading the kernel image, popping the making a root file system for it, and then running it. And the Debian one, for those of you running Debian, is tinyurl.com/MikePapaUniformGolfRomeo. And the only thing that I had to fix was a couple of his URLs, because this one was written in 2003, 2004. But either way, the version of his Debian was an older version, which actually works out quite well if you're running a honeypot, because you don't want to run up-to-date software that has all the security holes patched. I just had to change a couple URLs because his URLs were bad. But other than that, everything seemed to work fine, and it started up fine. Oh, yeah, and I couldn't install SSH because it was trying to grab the my current version, which was under the assumption that the version of Debian I was running on my computer and the version of Debian I was installing onto the honeypot was the same version, which was incorrect in this case. And how long did it take you to you run Gentoo? We won't hold that against you, but how long did it take you to set that up?
Actually, I rolled up my own image in that case. I actually have a couple other images. I have a Slackware 10.2 image, and not very long at all. Gentoo, of course, you build in a change root environment, anyways. So really, all you have to do is make in user mode Linux the file system is kept as a file. Basically on the host system.
Yes.
So Building it really was basically DDing out the image about the size that I wanted, formatting it, you know, change routing into the environment, doing the normal Gentoo install in that case, and just proceeding like a normal just install, really. There are also a lot of images that you can find that are even pre-built. If you go to, I think it's a user-mode-linux.sourceforge.net, and if you look through their front webpage, they actually, there's a guy who has images out there that you can actually download. So if you want to run, you know, Slackware, or he even has like Slackware 4.0, you know, as a honeypot image.
He basically has a honeypot image.
Right, he's already rolled out a lot of these images for you. So you can just even grab those or build your own. It's not that hard to really roll out your own image. It took me, several hours to build up my image. Really, I spent more time putting vulnerabilities into my images than anything.
Maybe we'll put back. He's got another honeypot question for us.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry to bug you guys again, but I'm just wondering, if you leave certain processes open to, well, susceptible to attack, you know, like things like Telnet or NetBIOS on Windows, would you notice people going after the machine faster, depending on what's open and what's not?
That's a good question.
Well, actually, in my case, as I said, I've been running my Gentoo image for a little while, and as I said, I'm probably gonna switch images several times. But from Snort, I really haven't noticed any, other than a lot of Microsoft SQL probes, a lot more attacks that would have been targeted toward Windows. Now, I don't know if it means that my upstream provider is maybe blocking some ports to keep me safe. Which would be kind of a pain in the ass. But I really haven't noticed that it would get attacked any faster. What about you there, Black?
I've noticed, in my case, it's a lot of the stuff that you see for, like, automated probes are just, like, worms. Like, for example, I've seen a boatload of, like, Microsoft Slammer SQL Server probes.
That's what I've seen, yeah. Same
yeah,
here.
And gobs of them. And the other big hit was the I think it's either, you know, it's Verizon's Wind servers doing something to me. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I mean if you're running services that are vulnerable to certain worms out there, you'll catch the worms, which I guess is like, you know, if you're interested in that, go right ahead. But at the same point, I'd be much more interested in having someone, you know, real and live at the other end of the line.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and it also comes back to what we were talking about before, was the, you know, what's the attack du jour? I mean, you can have a Telnet box open, but you can have a Telnet port open, but if no one tries Telnet anymore, you're hosed.
Yeah, that is true.
Yeah. So basically
really
what it is what I would do personally is I would, you know, just start watching Full Disclosure and, you know, Bug Track, and say, you know, if there's a giant, you know, OpenSSH flaw that just got posted, you know, run OpenSSH and see what happens there, because, you know, people will start, you know, scanning for it and looking for it, and all the skiddies will be out, you know, checking them out.
Also, another thing I did for, especially, you know, not necessarily Apache vulnerabilities, but add-ons like, you know, the AWSTAT or AW, God, I can't remember the name now. Anyways, was just go through my good working web server logs and see what's been hitting it. You know, so I'd see like lots of AWSTAT PL requests.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably a good thing to add in, you know. I mean, of course they didn't work on my regular web system, but it gave me a clue as to what people are looking for. So then I'd go and say, okay, let me find a good old archive copy of, you know, this crappy program, or, you know, this program that has lots of holes in it, and then throw it up there.
Mm-hmm.
To kind of speed things up.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, and that comes back down to the attack du jour.
Exactly, yeah.
All right.
You have to factor in, of course, though, how popular the exploits are. I mean, are there certain types of things that are more popular? Like, I don't know, things running on, say, like you guys were talking about, Apache, things like that, certain more popular programs over other ones? Would there be?
Well, yeah, I mean, what it boils down to is what is most likely to receive a hit. I mean, people are scanning for vulnerabilities that will most likely be unpatched.
Right.
I mean, people will be scanning for them. When I say people, I mean real people, as opposed to, like, we're talking about Slammer over here, and Slammer's been around for, what, 2 or 3 years? And that's just, you know, worms that people who haven't patched their systems yet, and they're infested with the virus. People will be scanning for vulnerabilities that just haven't been patched yet. So, for example, if you see tomorrow that, oh, there's a huge hole in Apache, you know, 1.3.3.4, if you're running, people will start looking for Apache 1.3.3.4 and start hitting it with this exploit.
Can they scan for newer exploits and the older ones at the same time, or does it work?
Oh, yeah, they can scan for whatever they want. If you want to, like, start banging against it, you can start trying for all kinds of things.
Okay. Well, thanks, guys.
All right.
All right.
I think we answered your question. I hope we did a good job.
Yeah.
Glad I could give you something to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, anytime, man.
All right. Take it easy.
Later. Okay, so you have your user mode Linux set up, and you have it full of exploits. I guess the next question with the other part of the honeypot you need to set up is you need to find out a way to monitor it. And the way with user mode Linux, you know, we talked about TTY logging, which is we discussed that already, and that's basically your first line of defense, because basically you'll have a nice little log of whatever the person did. Programs you can run on your host machine. For example, there's Snort, which is an intrusion detection system, and it's not the, you know, primo, you know, IDSs, the end-all IDSs, but it's free and it runs on Linux, and it's fairly okay. It's available at www.snort.org. And if you're running Snort, there's another add-on to it that provides all their alerts and everything with a nice web interface to it, and that's it's called BASE, or Acid BASE. Acid stands for Analysis Console for Intrusion Detection. And
yeah, actually, I think, they took that over. I think it now stands for Basic Analysis something. It stands for something different.
They actually merged?
Actually, it ended up forking.
Well, I know BASE installed, yeah.
Yeah, basically Acid wasn't being maintained anymore, so actually, a local group here in town ended up taking it over and started rewriting it and adding new code and making it better.
Yes, and they forked it, and then all the Acid people said, hey, use BASE, it's so much better now.
Nobody used, well, as I said, you know, Acid was pretty much non-supported anymore. I mean, it wasn't getting updated, and I think that's the reason why BASE came about. But, yeah.
And that's available at tinyurl.com/papaecho9whiskey8. And also there's everyone's favorite TCP dump, and that's basically will give you a nice little raw PCAP capture of everything that's going on over on your computer.
Which actually I do. I write out PCAPs for pretty much the entire session that I have the honeypot up. I write out PCAPs for, because then I can go back if I want to and use like TCP replay or something like that. If I want to, you know, and basically regenerate the attack or whatnot, and just basically grab all the information, all the traffic that happened while the attack was going on or whatnot.
All right. So now the other question, I guess we could sort of like go into our own little favorite stories here, because we're kind of running short on time.
Actually, I have one other thing that I also do, just real quick. I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, like, Tripwire, things like that. There's a program called Aid, and I actually made a tiny URL for it. It's tinyurl.com, 2 Sierra Sierra 2 Oscar, and because it's kind of a long URL. And it's very similar to Tripwire, and what I do is before I put my image online, I make a snapshot of it. Using something, it is very similar to Tripwire. so that whenever the system gets compromised, I can take the image offline, rerun it, and then see what files have changed, and then, you know, kind of mark what exactly has happened. But anyways.
That's actually a good idea. I should have done that beforehand. Oh, well. Because personally, I just set up my, I finally released my UML image out to the world this afternoon. I finally finished just the last bit right before the show, being like 8:45 rolls around, and I'm on the conf with Beav, and I said, okay, well, SSH is up now. just to have a quick thing, other thing, for those of you who aren't interested in running user mode Linux, there's another program out there called HoneyD, which is not quite a full-fledged honeypot, but it allows basically, it allows you the ability to emulate most of the features of a honeypot. HoneyD is a daemon that runs on the server and it eliminates a separate machine on the network. And basically, you can configure this, you know, faux machine to respond any which way until Sunday. You know, 100 millisecond latency, 10% packet loss. You know, return TCP fingerprint of a AX 4.2 server, etc. It's very interesting what they did with it. And basically, also what you can do is you can also configure it to point the services hosted on your own machine, say like Apache, or you can do what I did, and what they also tell you can do is run a bunch of scripts that emulate broken services so you can take a look at how people are probing you. I have a ton of scripts that just emulate a very badly secured machine. Like I was talking about my Telnet script, I have a web script that looks for HTTP requests, and if it looks like you're returning a code red attack or something like that was code red or NIMD or one of those, it will return you a response of, hey, it worked, so you could try to connect to it. It was pretty interesting. One of the things I actually did was set up a script that looked like an open relay for spam connections, and if you would send a spam connection and the person would connect to it and try to send a relay message out, and it would accept it, and it would log it to a file for me. And when I had like gobs amount of bandwidth when I was on Speakeasy, what I would do is I would send their probe message back to them when I was bored, and I'd watch them connect and start relaying messages through me, or what they thought was relaying messages to me. In reality, it just gets logged to my hard drive. So it was a fun feeling, you know, sitting there watching them waste their time and effort and me just, you know,
getting
doing
back.
taking a bullet for the internet for me. That's me.
Exactly. Getting back at them, yeah.
Look at me, I'm so nice. Someone should nominate me for a saint.
Ratchet, I nominate you for a saint.
Oh, thanks. The Church of Strom.
Ratchet.
Yes.
He's going to nominate me, but he'll just procrastinate it, and it'll never get done. You're never going to live that down, you know.
I know.
Yeah. So, well, we were talking about stuff that we did with what we noticed for the honeypot. You were talking about your slammer request and your other things. Have you gotten owned yet? Any super elite Chinese hackers?
No, not really. I've had a couple of things I've come across where they were close, but didn't really get to where I wanted them to get to.
Your friend's honeypot?
Now, my friend's honeypot was another matter. Actually, what had happened to him is he saw somebody trying to do, I believe it was the AWStatPL, one of those old bugs that had been out there for a while. And basically, he was going out and trying to grab a Perl bot to, you know, basically download the Perl bot and run it as Apache and join this particular IRC server so that they could pretty much control the machines from the IRC server, basically botnet. And what he decided to do was he was looking, even though it didn't actually get on the actual honeypot, he looked through and pulled down the bot code and saw that there were two administrators for the botnet. And one of them was called Doc, I believe, and one of them was called Timer. So he actually used Tor to connect to the IRC server that the person was controlling the botnet from, and connected up and saw that, sure enough, that Doc was logged in, D-O-C-K, and realized, wow, he's not using his other administrator account. So after chatting with the guy for a little while, who was evidently in Romania, which I've typically found, I run into a lot of botnet guys who are in Romania. I don't know what's up with that, but he saw that he wasn't using one of his admin accounts. So he kind of waited around, talked with the guy for a little while. The guy ended up, I think, taking him off the channel, whatnot, but waited around, figured the guy had to go to sleep at some point in time, and then ended up joining the channel and then changing his nick over to Timer, which was the other botnet controller. The guy had actually devoiced the channel, so he couldn't send, I guess he thought that he couldn't send commands through the botnet, but he could PM, private message, the each individual bot that was connected. So his big plan and his big Robin Hood move, I guess you could call it, was to tell each bot to, considering he had known what exploit he had come through, was to change mod 000 AWSAS PL first. Leave
so make
a little
it non-executable.
Log. Exactly. And then leave a little syslog message with the logger command. You know, echo, hey, your machine's been owned. Please upgrade AWSTATS or whatever you're using. And then proceeded in going through each particular bot and taking each one offline. Basically just going through, considering, I mean, he had the same control as the botnet owner. So he would just go through, send the botnet, like, first PS, and then it would ping him back, like, the process list. And then going through and just killing off each process. And so he would see each bot that was connected actually disconnect. So then he got it down to where. So he finally got the channel down to where there was no more bots left. And, of course, the original owner of the botnet wasn't around. And then pretty much just killed off everything that he had left behind. The only problem is the legalities of that. You're kind of at that point, even though you're trying to, you know, do something noble, and I guess you could say, you know, make sure these machines aren't vulnerable again, you're still, you know, modifying machines that are not yours. But, you know, he kind of had, like, the Robin Hood complex thing. He was like,
exactly. You know, I think Robin Hood was a very, very apt, I don't know, simile? Or was it analogy? That's
metaphor.
What I'm looking for.
Analogy, yeah.
Metaphor,
yeah.
Thank you. Leave it to the grammar Nazi.
Yeah, don't leave it open. Kill it all off, and then, you know, sure, it might give the admin a little bit of headaches, but at least they'd know, and at least the machine wouldn't be owned anymore. Because, you know, I mean, a lot of these guys turn around and use them for spam or whatever they can, you know, get away with at that point. So that was, like, pretty much his idea.
Well essentially, so, what your friend did to the admins was it's opposed to, you know, taking a Band-Aid off slowly or just ripping it off and dealing with the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just deal with the pain. You're
exactly.
Not going to have to fix it or anything, or as opposed to, you know, letting it fester there. And
Right. But, I mean, legally, that's a whole...
Yeah, exactly,
thing.
Exactly.
So I mean, as noble as it is, it probably isn't the best thing to do. And actually, he was using Tor because one of the big things, you know, he didn't want to connect up and then have the botnet owner know exactly where it's coming from because of
that could be an issue.
Work
mm-hmm.
with. Exactly, for, you know, the guy might get pissed and do, like, denial of service attacks on him. So, you know, Tor is a nice thing in that case. And a lot of these networks that run botnets are just really small networks or just machines that they've set up themselves. So, kind of interesting.
All right, well, we've got about 5 minutes left, so... Want to start
do we have announcements? Well, do we have announcements this week?
Let's see, DC2N3 this week. Don't forget Layer 1 in April. Layer1.info.
Yeah. I'll be going to Linux World April 3rd through 7th in Boston, so anyone in the general Boston area, I think I'll be there, Koresh will be there, Red Nerd will be there. I think my work has managed to give me all 4 days off, even though I only asked for one. So I'm not sure what the heck I'm going to be doing all those days, but I will be, you know, living on the convention floor, getting free stuff.
Partying.
Yep. Having my cheese and wine. There we go.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Beav, do you have any announcements you would like to make?
Oh, man. not really right off. No.
next week's show will be about Interzone, so if you have Interzone stories or, you know, gripes or whatever, send them in on into the show, and hopefully, you know, Strom will actually post this up to the archive so people will be able to listen to this request.
It'll be up tonight.
It'll better be. Shouts. Beav, do you have any shouts?
Oh, yeah, definitely the Telefreak crew. All my buddies over at Telefreak, the Death Row Cluster, the OpenBMS Death Row Cluster, all those guys who use that machine every frickin' day, or those machines, I should say, it is a cluster. That's about it.
Seriously, we have to, like, have you come on and talk about VMS and, like, the three people that use it that used a cluster.
Oh, dude, you should get on. You've never seen a cluster. We have so many people use a cluster.
Really?
Everybody thinks it's, like, three people, but if you get on the middle of the day, we always have, like, I don't know, 40, 50 people logged in to the cluster.
Are you sure it's, like, not, like, three people with, like, tons of Tor clients?
It could be. I don't know, but most of these people, no, most of them are in there because we have a BBS on the Death Row cluster, and some of them just get on for the BBS. Some of them just get on to use the machine for email. Some of them write code. Actually write code for VMS, believe it or not.
The sick, sad folks that they are.
I know.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't be mocking VMS people. I've never actually...
Aren't you a big AS400 guy?
Stank is. Stank will be sitting there going, like, listen to this going, oh, man, VMS guys. The only people who use VMS are, like, child molesters and...
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
But, yeah, that's about the end of my shout-outs there.
Strom, do you have any shouts?
Shouts to Mebufo for asking totally awesome questions. And
Indeed.
And shouts to the Auto Club of Southern California.
Did you break down lately?
No, they make dealing with the DMV much easier.
Oh, okay. I'll send shouts out to Patrillo, too, for showing out there. And I guess if you want to talk about honeypots on VMware, go listen to his TWA Tech episode. That's twatech.org. I don't know. Shouts to you, Beav, for coming on and basically turning me on to this whole user mode Linux thing, which I've never actually... I played with lightly in, like, 2003, but beyond that, I was never ever even thought of actually setting it up like this. Silly me. Site of the week is www.honeybee.org. H-O-N-Y... No, sorry, spelling that wrong. Oh, man, I'm tired. H-O-N-E-Y-D.org. Email, please email us. Come on, email us your Interzone stories or anything over the past 3 or 4 weeks that people have missed. We have completely discussed the yig/dig topic to death. Thank you very much. Radio@binrev.com. As always.
Yeah.
Strom, what's closing music tonight?
Closing music is something from OC Remix. It's actually a pretty sweet remix of some music from Mario Paint, surprisingly.
All right. Well, we'll be looking forward to listening to that.
Yeah.
So, as always, we will see you next week. Same hack time.
Same hack channel.